This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. And I am pleased to have our guest joining us from TomPaine.com, Rick Shankman, who's the managing editor there. Mr. Shankman, thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon.
Well, I appreciate that you were able to be with us to talk about TomPaine.com and also to perhaps broaden the discussion beyond just what you're doing there into how we get some sort of meaningful and good content in the media instead of so much fluff and junk, or at least that's my opinion. Can we let the listeners know about TomPaine.com? I checked out the website. It's really interesting.
Well, good. Well, today's our official debut day, so it's a big day for us here. Basically, TomPaine.com is a web magazine. We publish on four different subjects. One, we do media criticism. Two, we cover money and politics. Three, the environment. And four, and this is the area that I'm most excited about because of my background as a historian, we are having historians from around the country comment daily on breaking events, trying to put them into perspective. And that's something that nobody else is doing.
I agree with that. Very, very few people, if anybody, are doing that, and certainly not in the kind of current context.
Right. Nobody's doing it on a daily basis,
right,
consistently at least.
Can you talk a little bit more about why you feel that that's so important? I mean, I think I know why I feel it is, but can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, Americans, of course, just really don't like to pay much attention to history. We're a forward-looking country. We're a future-looking country. And in many ways, of course, that's a great benefit. The problem is that it means that we tend to approach every issue as if it's the sun coming up over the horizon for the first time ever, and we lack perspective. And what we're going to try and do is try to have these great historians around the country help us understand things, put them in context.
Well, and that is really a very, very important issue, is that so often people are being asked to make, you know, tremendous decisions about where our country is going and what we want our policies to be, both domestically and internationally, but being asked to do this in a vacuum.
Sure. Let's just use a nice concrete example. This last year, there were a lot of commentators in the media who were making the argument, gee, you know, politics has just turned so bitterly partisan. How awful for our country. And historians would argue, oh, yes, this was a bitterly partisan period during that whole impeachment drive. But we've actually had periods where there was even more bitterness and more partisanship shown, probably in the first 10 years of the history of the country. It was more bitter than it's ever been subsequently. So we managed to survive it, even though while we're in that kind of a mode, it's pretty distressing. And it's that kind of perspective. It's a little bit of the, yes, we've seen it all before perspective, so the people don't get quite so alarmed and jittery.
Yeah, that way they're not seeing it. They're going, oh, my God, it's all falling apart. This has never happened before.
That's right, yeah. And that's so, for people who don't have a good sense of history, there is this sense whenever we're in a crisis that, my gosh, the country is going to hell, and we're going to be dragged down. We're going to become like the Roman Empire or something. We're going to disappear.
We did a story on that, actually. I had a historian on a few weeks ago, and we actually talked about the Roman Empire and compared it to the United States, and he said there was no comparison whatsoever.
No, there's absolutely no comparison. We don't want to get off on the Roman Empire.
No, actually, we don't. We're talking with Rick Shankman, who's the managing editor of TomPaine.com. Mr. Shankman, let me ask you, how did you get involved with doing TomPaine.com? Where do you come from that leads you here today?
Well, I've been a journalist and a historian for the last 20, 25 years of my adult life, and I kind of bounce back and forth between careers. I've written 5 history books, and I've also been a television reporter, an investigative reporter, and political reporter. And with this job, when this came along last year, it was a perfect melding of my two interests. So for me, this is nirvana. This is a chance to still be working in history, but also being involved in current events. It's a great, great job. I kid my boss that I've got the best job in the media.
Well, I think you might be right about that, because certainly it seems, well, let me ask you, are we heading towards a time when broadcast and hard copy kind of print paper journalism is a thing of the past, and everybody will simply be getting all of their information and entertainment over the internet?
Well, I doubt that the internet will supplant all these other sources of information. I think that each of them has virtues, but what we don't understand is quite what the mix will be. I can remember attending a conference over a decade ago at Berkeley predicting that the networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC at that time, were going to go the way of the dinosaurs, that they were on the road to extinction. Well, here we are over a decade later, and they're still out there. They don't command the audience that they used to, but they still command a larger audience than any other medium out there. They can still on a good night get, 30, 40 million people. Well, that's just an enormous number. And the internet doesn't even come close to commanding that kind of a number. Not where you have one site commanding that kind of a number, or even two or three sites. And so I don't think that the change is going to be revolutionary. It's going to be evolutionary. It's going to be something that takes a generation. And then, in the year, 2020 or so, we'll be able to sit and make an assessment.
It's very interesting, because when you're talking about the networks and their oft-predicted demise, I grew up in Chicago, and I remember throughout my years living there, I would go downtown on State and Randolph, and there was always this store, and it had plastered over its windows, "Going out of business, big sale." and that place was going out of business. It's probably still there. I mean, yeah. It was going out of business for 20 years that I lived in Chicago, and it's going out of business next week. And it sounds to me that on some level, maybe when we hear people talking about the networks, we're talking about the same phenomenon. They're going out of business, but not until next week, and that never gets here.
Right. Yeah. Although, of course, unlike the owner of that little store that you used to visit, that was a good marketing ploy.
Right.
For the networks, they don't want anybody to think that they're going out of business next week.
Yeah, that's for sure. We're talking.
They at least want their advertisers to think they're going to be around for a while.
Right. We're talking with Rick Schenkman, who is the managing editor of TomPaine.com. Mr. Schenkman, one of the topics that you said was a major focus of TomPaine.com is money and politics. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, most people are convinced that the system back here in Washington is corrupt in some way. And they're not sure exactly how, but they're sure that the special interests, through their lobbying, through their campaign contributions, are somehow fouling up the system. And you know what? We're convinced of that as well. And what we are trying to do is shine a spotlight on the abuses when we see them and try to help explain to people where the legislation to reform the system is, what it's trying to do, what its weaknesses are, what its strengths are. Everybody talks about, for instance, the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill, which will basically close the soft money loophole. And there, I think the media has left the impression with people that, close the soft money loophole and that solves the problem. Well, it doesn't even come close to solving the problem. After, even if you got McCain-Feingold, you got it through the Congress, even after all that, and you had this huge battle about it, and somehow you managed to get it through this Republican Congress, even after all that, you'd still have rich people and special interests having the dominant influence over what happens in this town. And people need to understand that.
I guess the question that I would ask is that certainly, while it may not be fully explained to the American people in a cognizant way placed in context, which is something, of course, that TomPaine.com is attempting to do. One of the questions that I always have for just about everybody who comes on this program is, do people out in the country, do they really care? Do they care enough to actually do something? I think whenever a light is shown, as you so state, there's plenty of cockroaches scattering everywhere. And that light gets shown over and over again, but yet it seems that this is an issue that people don't get behind in order to really try and affect some kind of real change. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that you've made a good observation. And one of the problems that reformers have in Washington is that there is not this overwhelming groundswell of public opinion forcing Congress to take action. And that's a problem. That's democracy. That's always a problem. Until the people get really excited about something, it's hard to achieve major change. And genuine campaign finance reform would bring major change. It would upset the established course of doing business here in this town. So short of the people really rising up, you wind up having debates on fairly narrow grounds, like this business with McCain-Feingold. Let's end the soft money loophole, and boy, that's enough. That's all we can attempt to do. It's a problem. What can I say? I wish there were a firestorm of outrage out there, and people would say, this just shouldn't go on any further. But, you know, we've got peace and prosperity. The country seems to be in pretty good shape. And so people get on with their own private lives, and I can't blame them for that.
This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments. We're talking with Rick Shankman of TomPaine.com. Mr. Shankman, you used a phrase, and you talked about it would shake up the normal course of doing business in this town. You're in that town. Can you talk a little bit about what the normal course of business is?
Oh, that's easy. The normal course of business here is that the politicians spend half their time, and I am not joking when I say half their time, spend half their time trying to raise money for their campaigns or their parties. And the people that have the money aren't guys who are making $25,000 a year or $30,000 a year. They're guys who are making $1 million a year who can afford to give a $25,000 campaign contribution to one of the political parties. And so the politicians are constantly in the company of rich people or people who have access to money, and that means special interests. That means when they're talking to those guys, they're not talking to people like you and me.
Really, when one looks at some of the legislation that comes out of Congress, and then when one compares that with the donor list to various parties and or individual political candidates, I mean, it really is. We're talking about bribery here. I think people, you know, want to shy away sometimes from using that word because it sounds a little too harsh for some sensitive ears, and in particular, some sensitive ears in the media. I mean, I would very, very much like to be in a position to go ask some of these very wealthy and powerful congressmen and women and businessmen and women and say, you know, gee, this looks like bribery. Can you explain to me why it isn't? But yet, those questions very rarely get asked, if ever.
I'll tell you, the problem is that reporters are tired of hearing the answer. Here's the answer that's given.
I've never heard it put that way.
A decade ago, and I remember Jake Garn giving me this answer. It's an old answer, and it works in so many cases. Here's what the politicians say. For instance, Bill Bradley, when he was a senator in New Jersey, had a lot of pharmaceutical companies in his state. And so he would try to enact legislation that was promoted by these pharmaceutical companies. And then the Center for Public Integrity chided him for accepting contributions from the pharmaceutical industry and also the securities industry and some other big industries that are kind of based in and around New Jersey. And Bradley's answer was, well, you know, fact of the matter is, yes, I took their money, but they're important constituents in my state, so I would be paying attention to them even if I didn't get any money from them, because they're my constituents as much as Joe the milkman down the block. In fact, that's part of the reality. It's not like if you got campaign finance reform, suddenly these guys are going to be legislating on behalf of the average Joe. They are going to be paying attention to the major employers in their state, the businessmen who command a lot of power in their states. That's always going to happen. That's not really the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is that right now, when you go into the voting booth and you pull that lever, you think that you're exercising your democratic right to vote and that it really means something. But in fact, it's more important to those guys to get to the politicians, to get the support of the special interests, than it is to get your measly little vote. Because if they get enough money from these special interests, then they can not quite buy your vote, but they can use television to squish their opponents and to just keep getting elected and reelected over and over again.
Well, you bring up, I think, the essential point, and that is, well, for example, I think George Bush Jr. is a good example of that. He's raised so much money so quickly, that's been publicized so much, that people who may actually try to mount a challenge for the Republican presidential nomination, they simply can't even do it because they need to raise money too. The people they would raise money from would say, you know, gee, he's got so much money already, you don't have a chance. We can't back you. So therefore, they don't even have the opportunity to try and run. Therefore, the people couldn't even vote for somebody else if they wanted to because this is your choice. Take it or leave it.
Well, we just, on our debut issue, we published several pieces on this very topic. It's what we call the wealth primary, or what some other people call the money primary. Long before the voters get to go to the polls and pull their lever down in New Hampshire, say next February, the primary that really counts is happening right now. It's the money primary. George W. Bush is the winner, hands down, of this primary. He has gotten thousands of rich people to give him a lot of money. That means he is in the catbird seat. And so long before the voting takes place in February, he's declared the winner by virtue of the fact that he can get all these rich people to give him money. It's that simple.
End of story.
So he's the winner of the wealth primary. And in fact, we've got an ad in the New York Times today, and every week we'll have ads in the New York Times. And this week's on the wealth primary, and we're basically thanking George Bush. So kind of a left-handed, backhanded compliment. We're thanking him for putting the wealth primary on the map because he has been so outrageous in the way that he has accumulated money for his campaign war chest that everybody now understands that there is this money primary that takes place before the Democratic voters primary, and it, in fact, maybe more important.
We're talking with Rick Shankman, managing editor of TomPaine.com. Mr. Shankman, you ready to take a phone call?
Oh, sure.
Caller, you're live on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I was listening to your talk, you know, and I consider myself a conservative, but the way you guys phrase this, you make it sound like George Bush Jr. is taking soft money, when in fact, that is the type of money that anybody can donate to somebody. And it's one of the problems that I have with current campaign reform is one side tends to have a lack of objectivity about the reform, and they only want to limit the other side. Like when it comes to soft money, they want to take the ability of large corporations from being able to give people money, but they don't want to limit the unions. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Thank you for calling in.
Thanks.
Sure. You're drawing some distinctions, which is good. George W., in his accumulation of his whatever it is now, $37 million in June, it's probably going to be up to $50 million here another couple of weeks or so, I think is what they're going to announce, $50 million that he's collected. He's collected all that money, not in soft money contributions, but in the form of individual contributions. And there's by federal law, there's a maximum of $1,000. But what happens is a rich person volunteers to become one of the George W. Bush pioneers. And he goes out and he promises he'll raise $100,000. And he goes out and he finds 100 buddies of his who will all put in $1,000 into the pot. Well, mostly it tends to be pretty rich people or executives with big companies who have a lot of business before the federal government or before the Texas state government. And it's not the smaller contributions that are really financing his vast accumulation of money. It's not $25 contributions by millions of people. This is it's tending to be pretty large contributions. Now, the problem here is, you know, we get into this, we're so used to large numbers being thrown at us, you know, $500,000 for this function or for that function, that $1,000 no longer seems like that's that large of money, that large amount of money. But that's still a sizable amount of money. And that's a game that only the top 1% or so in this country can play. And in fact, only about 1% of the people in this country ever contribute to political campaigns. So ask yourself, who are the people who are doing the contributing? Is it just people who are good, have good consciences? No, they want to get something done. Now, the caller talked about the unions. That's absolutely right. The unions are giving money, and it might be just as malodorous as the corporate executives who get together and give money as well. I think the system stinks the way it is now.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's really the issue, is the whole system is corrupted, and I mean, I think we have to find a way to do something to change that. I'm not pretending to have all the answers, and certainly, you know, I don't think George Bush is any worse of a devil than any of the other politicians who are out there. They're all playing the same game. We're talking with Rick Schenkman, who's the managing editor of TomPaine.com. Rick, let me ask you if we can we move to the issue of the media? Maybe a segue for doing that would be this whole sort of media circus that has happened around GW's alleged use of drugs, up to and including cocaine. What is our media doing, and what do they need to do better?
Well, I'll tell you what they're not doing is they're not covering the issues, and that's the problem. We've got a great piece by a fellow by the name of Mort Mintz. He was a reporter at the Washington Post for about 30 years. He's now retired. He wrote about a 2,500, 3,000-word essay on how the media has already blown the coverage of the 2000 election. It's not even the year 2000 yet. And they've blown it because during the first nine months or so of this year, when George W. was becoming the anointed leader of the Republican Party, the great newspapers of this country were ignoring his record. Nobody was examining his record. So Mort goes back, and he examines the record, and he says, this is what we should have been told 6 months ago, 7 months ago, 8 months ago, and we weren't being told it. And that's a problem.
It seems to me, and certainly from doing this show and having a number of guests on, people like Norman Solomon, Bob Peer, yourself, people who look at the media, it seems that our media seems to be very, very much focused in the wrong areas, focused on, you know, street crime, sex stories, celebrity stories, fluff stories. They seem very, very reticent to go after the meat of issues. And I was wondering, why do you think that is?
Well, there's lots of reasons for it, and it all depends which media you're talking about. If you're talking about local news, they're all interested in human interest stories with which they can attract a large mass audience. You know, if, for instance, you are the news director of a television station in a city, well, you could cover the city council race in that local city, and that might actually be of interest to the people who live in that city. But in almost every city in this country, television stations don't just broadcast to the people in one city. They broadcast to suburbs and to other cities, all in the outlying area. And the advertisers don't care whether somebody is living in the city or they're living in the suburbs. They just want to know that they can reach these people. Well, if you do a story on that local city council race that only the people in that particular city care about, you lose the rest of your audience. And probably they turn the station because they're not interested in the city council race in Topeka, Kansas. They live outside Topeka. that's a real problem. So that's one area. And you have to really dissect it and go medium by medium. If you go into the newspapers, they're looking for the suburban readership because that's where the money is. That's where the advertising is. So they tend not to cover inner city problems. Very simple reason. The inner city people aren't providing the bulk of the newspaper market anymore. So their problems get ignored. And we could go on and just taking industry by industry, but that's kind of how you have to do it. You can't. I think it's not helpful to people to make a broad generalization about the media. You've
right.
got to explain what the particular problems are that each that the executives at each step of the process face.
But the one thing I think that we perhaps can broaden out to all of quote unquote the media is that so much of it is dependent on private. Corporate business advertising dollars, and so therefore maximizing that income becomes the priority as compared to making the priority actually serving the populace by giving them real news that they can use, which is what TomPaine.com is attempting to do.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that's a great, wonderful statement. I might be quoting you.
Well, that's great.
Look, we're a nonprofit. Even though we're called TomPaine.com, we're nonprofit, and what we are trying to do is report the news without fear or favor, to use the great slogan from the New York Times. And we don't have any stockholders that we have to please. We don't have to make any money. All we're trying to do is call them as we see them.
We've been speaking with Rick Schenkman, who is the managing editor of TomPaine.com. Rick, any final thoughts for our audience, and also how can they find TomPaine.com on the web?
All right. All they need to do is type into their internet browsers www.TomPaine.com, which is named for Tom Paine, the Revolutionary War patriot who penned the great tract Common Sense, which helped us establish our independence.
And any final thoughts for our audience today?
Well, I hope that people click on, and if they've got any feedback, they can either write me a letter at editor@TomPaine.com, or they can go onto the bulletin board system, and they can express themselves that way. But we want to get a lot of feedback. We want to find out if the website works for them, if it's functional, and we want to find out what they think of the articles we've got posted.
Rick Schenkman, managing editor of TomPaine.com. Thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. It's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you this edition of the program today. If you'd like more information about Full Logic Reverse, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by phone, 530-265-9462. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.